One of the temptations we all have is to idealize the past and to put on special spectacles and look back to a golden age, either in our own life or the life of the world, when everything was much better than it is now. Well, nostalgia isn't what it used to be, but Christians do the same thing. And many Christians look back to a certain age in church history which they think was ideal and try and relive it. For example, some people go back to the Welsh Revival. If you go to Wales, they talk about 1904 and, oh, it was wonderful in those days. Others go further back to the Methodist Revival in the 18th century. Then there's quite a large number of Christians in England who idealize the Puritan era. If only we were like the Puritans again. Others go back to the Reformation. There's a resurgence of interest in the Anabaptists of the 16th century at the moment, and it's influencing a lot of Christians in this country. They go even further back. When were the good old days, the days of the church fathers, or the New Testament period? Surely the church was ideal in the New Testament period. Well, it wasn't. The church of the New Testament had problems. They had pressures from outside, but they had big problems from inside. I want to say something right away. The church was never destroyed by pressure from outside. That just makes the church stronger. But problems inside can destroy a church. And when we turn to the Corinthian letters of Paul, we're turning to a church with big problems. There is no church that Paul founded that had bigger problems than Corinthians. But thank God for those problems. Without them, we wouldn't have had these two marvelous letters. We wouldn't have 1 Corinthians 13, that matchless song of love. We wouldn't have 1 Corinthians 15, which is the earliest account of the resurrection appearances of the Lord in the New Testament, while many of the witnesses were still alive. And it's earlier than any of the four Gospels. So we wouldn't have any of this. Now, mind you, the church had big problems. They were very deeply divided. They had parties and cliques following different ministers. They had immorality of the worst kind. It was openly known, not just in the church, but in the whole of Corinth, that in this church there was a man living in sin with his mother, or possibly his mother-in-law, but certainly in a forbidden relationship, which even pagans would have condemned. They were getting drunk at the Lord's table. Fancy that. People arriving for communion and scoffing all the bread before other people came and drinking all the wine and lying drunk so that by the time the congregation arrived, there were drunk church members around the communion table. Can you imagine it? You and I would have written off such a church. We'd have said, it's no good. Don't go near it. Paul did not. He didn't write them off. He sought to bring them through to a better position. They had all kinds of aggressive feminism. There's nothing new under the sun, is there? All right, let's then look at the churches of Corinth. But first, I think we want to look at the city. Its position not only affected the city, but affected the church very deeply. It's on that narrow isthmus of land which joins the mainland of Greece to the Peloponnese. And it's a very narrow strip of land there. And that's very significant, because ships invariably came this way, and if they were big ships, they discharged their cargo at Corinth, and the cargo was carried a few miles over the land and put on another ship to go east. The smaller boats were actually pulled out of the water and pulled on rollers across a little road across there, and then launched again. Why on earth then didn't ships go around here? Because this is a very dangerous part of the Mediterranean Sea. It's like Cape Horn. And it really is dangerous. And to avoid, especially in the winter storms, to avoid going round that cape, ships came in here and either had their cargo taken across or even the boats manhandled across and put back in the water. So Corinth was a key port. Actually, Corinth was about 2 miles from the sea, and it had its own port, Lycium, here. And there was a double city wall, 2 miles from the port up to the city of Corinth, to protect the road to the port. Just outside Corinth was a mountain, Mount Acrocorinthus, here. And from the top of that mountain, well, it was only 2,000 feet high, but from the top of it, you could actually see Athens 40 miles away. Now, I like to parallel cities in the ancient world with cities of today. This is Edinburgh, that's Glasgow. Apologies to all Scots here. But in fact, this was the sort of refined city with the university and where the philosophers lived and so on. This was where the Festival of Arts was held. Whereas this was the port, the shipbuilding place, and the Glaswegians lived here and the Edinburgh people lived here. So that gives you a kind of feel. So Athens and Corinth were real rivals. And again, like Scotland, they were at either side of the narrow bit of land that joined one part to another. Well, that gives you a little feel of the place. Archaeologists have discovered a great deal in Athens, in Corinth, especially since the earthquake of 1858, which revealed some of the ruins. And the main picture here, forget this for a moment, is the main street of Corinth, as it was in Paul's day. It's all been excavated now. And they've found the bema, the judgment seat, where Paul was judged. They've found all sorts of things, including the Jewish synagogue. So they've really revealed an awful lot. And everything tallies with Luke's account in the book of Acts. There's the mountain, 2,000 feet high, from which you could see Athens, 40 miles away. The port is down this way. Nowadays, of course, they don't manhandle ships over the top. They've cut this gigantic deep ravine, the Corinthian Canal, right through, and an ocean-going liner can just squeeze through. If you go cruising in the eastern Mediterranean, you may well go through this canal now. Nero tried to cut the canal way back in Paul's day, but he failed, and it wasn't till the 19th century that this deep cut was actually made that cuts off northern Greece from the Peloponnese. So that's the background. Another thing that we need to know is that this was actually the second city of Corinth. There were two cities. The first one went back a long way, and it was very wealthy and terribly pagan. They worshipped, for example, Poseidon, the god of the sea, and above all, Aphrodite. They had a huge temple here originally, which had 2,000 priestesses. They were actually prostitutes, and worship was quite exciting in those days. You simply went and had intercourse with a priest. And you can imagine the effect that had. Apart from the fact that being a port was sailors, well, enough said. In fact, to say that a woman was a Corinthian was to call her a prostitute. And to Corinthianize became an actual verb in the Greek language, meaning to have promiscuous sex. So that was the reputation it had. It was a bad city. And incidentally, the place of all those priestesses was going to affect the Corinthian church, because the women wanted to do things that men were doing. And the background explains a great deal of why Paul concentrates on men and women relationships in Corinthian correspondence. Well, now that city was destroyed. It was a bad city. It was destroyed. And the Romans destroyed it 150 years before Christ. And then later, not long before Christ came, they rebuilt it and repopulated it with a very different population. Mostly freed men. That means ex-slaves who had either bought their freedom or earned it in some way. And so they were ex-slaves who populated the city. But again, because of its position, they made a lot of money. It became wealthy, trading obviously, and it became again an immoral seaport. But it meant that there were very few noble or well-educated people. It was full of self-made wealthy traders, self-made men. Well, now, that again affects the Corinthian church membership. Paul says to the church members, not many noble among you, not many high-born. You're very ordinary people. You're from the bottom of the social heap. And they were. But they were not poor. They were good traders. They were wealthy. They'd made a lot of money. But they were people who'd worked up from the bottom, as it were, by their own efforts. Ex-slaves, now trading in the seaport. Now, all that background is fairly important. Both the social background and the moral background crept into the church. Snobbery is very widespread among those who are not truly high-born. Do you know what I mean? Those who've climbed up the social ladder by their own efforts tend to be the worst kind of snobs, don't they? And think they're high and mighty because they've done it by their own efforts. The truly high-born are usually quite humble people. But the snobs are those who've worked their way up themselves. And that kind of snobbery invariably begins to compare minister with minister and begins to form cliques and divisions in a church. See how the background is coming into the church. It happens with all our churches. We've all got a background. And we come to Christ, you don't immediately lose all your background. And you bring it into the church. And that creates problems which are not really spiritual problems, but social problems. See, and there are social problems in churches in England, don't let's fool ourselves. And there are moral problems because of our background. We were each brought up to regard different things as right and wrong. And when you get it together, you know, some Christians say it's wrong to touch alcohol, some say it's okay, and so it goes on. And some places like Norway, the Christians smoke like factory chimneys, and other places they don't. And these differences of moral behavior are often due to background and not due to principle. And you've got to learn to live together as Christians with your different backgrounds and upbringing. All that kind of thing comes out very well in the Corinthian correspondence. The two biggest battles in any church, however, are these. How to keep the church in the world and how to keep the world out of the church. And most problems pastorally can be put under one of those two heads. And we're going to see that particularly here. You realize that the first city was very Greek, but the second city was very Roman. It was still just as immoral, but it was a different kind of culture. And it's the Roman culture that was quite strong in Corinth. The Roman law was the law in Corinth. And that emphasis on law meant that some of the church members in Corinth were actually going to law against one another. And litigation was very, very common in Corinth. And that had crept into the church. So actually you had church members taking other church members to court and suing them. And all this is very reminiscent of a self-made community with people rising up the ladder by their own efforts and by their own money-making. Now we've a further complication. Not only were there two cities here, but Paul wrote four letters to the two cities, or to the city there was in his day, and we've only got two of them. And I'm going to complicate things very much in your minds by telling you that the first letter to the Corinthians is actually his second letter to the Corinthians, and the second letter to the Corinthians is actually his fourth letter to the Corinthians. And there were two others which we've lost, and what we know of them, we're rather glad that we have lost them. One was a very hasty letter, which Paul perhaps later regretted writing. He acknowledges he wrote in haste and he'd written in too much of a hurry. And the other was a very hot letter. And he acknowledges that it was a bit too hot. So we've lost the hot letter and the hasty letter. But let me try and put it all together for you, if we can. And it is going to be complicated. Paul actually paid three visits to the city. First, second, and third. But he wrote four letters. The first letter, the second letter, the third, and the fourth. And meanwhile, he sent delegates to the church with his letters and to try and sort things out. He first sent Timothy with the second letter, which is R1 Corinthians. Isn't it complicated? So if you just write two instead of one and four instead of two, you're right. So he sent Timothy. Timothy, I'm afraid, was too timid, and he left the church in a worse state than he found it. And he came back and reported to Paul they're worse than ever. They just didn't respond to my approach. Titus was made of sterner stuff. And we'll find that when we study the letters to Timothy and Titus. Titus was tough, whereas Timothy was timid. And so Paul, after Timothy's visit failed, sent Titus. And Titus succeeded in sorting them out and brought better news back. So there was a constant coming and going. See, by this time, Paul had left Corinth and was very busy elsewhere. He'd been to Jerusalem. He was now back in Ephesus. And it was between Ephesus and Corinth that all this traffic went on. So just running through it, he paid a first visit. After he'd left, 18 months he stayed and got the church going, but it was a problem church from the beginning. After he'd left, a bad report came to him that things going really wrong in the church. So he sent the first letter, the hasty one. He scribbled a note to them telling them to put things right. But another report came from a family that came to Ephesus, Chloe's household, brought a further bad report showing that the first letter had had the exact opposite reaction. And a letter written in haste can do that. And they just reacted violently against Paul's first letter. But we don't know. It may be found, part of it, in 2 Corinthians 6 to 7. That's a conjecture. We don't know. But that little bit sounds a bit like that hasty letter, which tried to put things right with a big hammer, you know? And it didn't do it. Sometimes it's like straightening out a dent in your car. If you've got a dent in your car wing, don't take a hammer and hit the middle of the dent at the back. You'll crack it. You have to tap it around the dent and gradually keep on tapping and work in towards the center until it gets it nicely out. Otherwise, you do more harm than good. Well, Paul tried the big hammer and it just didn't work. So Chloe's household brought a bad report. So he sent a letter back, or rather he got a letter also brought by three of them. And this letter had a lot of questions they wanted to ask. They wanted to ask about spiritual gifts. They wanted to ask about marriage and divorce. They didn't want to ask about their problems significantly. It's interesting. People always come to you with questions, but not problems. Do you know what I mean? And so Chloe's household had brought the report of the problems, and Stephanus, Fortunatus, and Achaicus had brought a letter with questions for him. So what he did was, he sent what we know as the First Corinthian letter with Timothy, and that letter from Paul to the Corinthians, brought by Timothy, covered both the questions of the letter and the problems that Chloe's household had told tales about. And that's how we got 1 Corinthians. And when you go through 1 Corinthians, you've got to decide, now, is this an answer to one of their questions? Or is it Paul dealing with one of the tales that this family had told him? All right? Well, that first letter went. And then a report came back to Paul. They're worse than ever. Talk about the care of all the churches. So this time, Paul paid a second visit, and that visit was a disaster. And it just all went wrong. So Paul had his occasions like we do, and everything went wrong. And Paul just had to leave. He just couldn't do any good. And so he left. That's when he sent his third letter with Titus. And that third letter we've lost, unless we've got it at the end of 2 Corinthians, chapters 10 to 13. That's a possibility, because that is a very hot section of the second letter. Very hot indeed. Paul resorts to sarcasm. And as every school teacher knows, you've got pretty desperate when you resort to sarcasm. It's the temptation of all teachers to be sarcastic to pupils. But anyway, that third hot letter went with Titus, but Titus was a good man to sort out problems. Paul often left Titus behind to sort out problems. He just seemed to have that firmness that said, no nonsense, we're not having any more nonsense, let's put it right. Timothy was a bit too timid. He said, please, let's try and put it right. But Titus said, come on, we're not standing any more of this, let's put it right. And he put it right. And now a report came from Corinth that things were very much better. And Paul was so delighted that he sent a fourth letter with Titus again. And this is what we call 2 Corinthians. And then Paul finally paid a third and last visit to them, a very happy visit. So he had his first visit when he started them, a second visit which went terribly wrong, and he just had to leave. He was just not able to communicate with them. And the third visit, which was happy again. Well, now that's the kind of trouble that Paul had with just one church. And we have these two letters. But again, thank God that we have them. The contrast between the two letters is quite marked. The first letter deals with practical issues. The second letter deals with personal insults. The whole of the second letter, Paul is outraged at the way they've insulted him. And they really did. So practical issues, personal insults. The first letter is about what he thought was wrong with them. The second letter is all about what they thought was wrong with him. All right? If you get these things in your mind simply as contrasts, you're more able to understand the letters. The first letter concentrates on church members and how church members ought to behave. But the second letter concentrates on ministers, pastors, leaders, and how they ought to be behaving. So that there's a very clear contrast between the two letters. If you've read them, you must have noticed. Let me run through them again. First letter, practical issues. Second letter, personal insults. First letter, what Paul thought about the Corinthians. Second letter, what the Corinthians thought about Paul. First letter, how church members ought to be. Second letter, how church ministers ought to be. Well, now that's given you a feel, I hope, of the two letters. So now we can look in more detail at the first letter to Corinth. And we'll look at this one first. Now, let's just try and get the feel of it. It's a sandwich. And we'll forget the bread at the moment. We'll look at the filling. But it's a sandwich between the crucifixion and the resurrection. And it begins with the cross, it ends with the resurrection. Now forget that for the moment. Let's look at what's in the middle. Now I told you that Paul was dealing with two things. First, the report from Chloe's household about what was going wrong. And secondly, the letter brought by three men with questions. So there's a mixture in the middle filling of the sandwich between Paul's dealing with the problems that have been reported to him and Paul answering their questions that had come in the letter. But he doesn't deal with all those and then all those. He sort of darts about a bit, I think, to kind of disguise a little that he's slipping in what he's heard. Do you see what I mean? So he deals with a series of problems, but something like two-thirds or just over half the problems he's heard about, and half of them they have asked about. See? Let's take them. The things he's heard, which they haven't mentioned in the letter, but which he knows are happening: division among the members, immorality in the membership, members taking each other to court and suing each other, litigation, idolatry creeping in, the relationship of men and women, and particularly their role in the church, and this matter of getting drunk at the Lord's Supper and abusing it. You see, in those days, the Lord's Supper was a full meal. And it would be nice if it still was, actually. And from time to time in our church in Guildford, we had a communion where we had a full meal. And on each table, for each group of Christians, there was a cup and a piece of bread. And at the end of the meal, we passed that round. That's how it was done in the early church. It was part of a meal together. The meal bit dropped largely because of the abuse at Corinth. And the meal was reduced to a little bit of bread and a little bit of wine. And that stopped people eating it all and getting drunk. So I'm afraid we lost something because of Corinth's abuse. I don't know if you realize that. It was meant to be a love feast, a meal, at the end of which we remembered Jesus. And I think it would be lovely if we went back to that. But what happens when you have meals in church? People try to put on a better meal than the last lot put on, you know what I mean? And even house group food tends to enlarge and enlarge until you don't get any prayer. You just eat together, do you know what I mean? We've seen it happen. So these were the problems that Paul had heard about, and he writes to put them right. And then they had asked him about marriage and divorce and remarriage, which is the key issue. Incidentally, the Bible never says divorce is a sin. It does say that remarriage is. That's a very important distinction. They were asking about meat offered to idols, because most of the meat that they bought had already been involved in a pagan religious ceremony. As, for example, New Zealand mutton is today. Since New Zealand lost the European market for its mutton, they have to sell the mutton mainly to the Middle East now, where there's a big market for it. Mutton is the favorite meat in Arabia. And, of course, to do that, they now have to have Muslim mullahs in New Zealand to supervise the killing of the lambs and to say prayers over the killing of the lambs. So if you buy New Zealand mutton today, you're buying mutton that has already been involved in a Muslim ceremony. Do you understand? That's exactly the problem they had in Corinth, because the slaughterhouse was a religious place and the meat was offered to idols before it was on sale in the marketplace. And that created a conscience problem for Christians. Should we eat meat that has been offered to idols, or should we become vegetarian because of the idolatry that lies behind the slaughtering? You follow me? Well, that was a problem. So they asked about marriage and divorce and remarriage. They asked about meat offered to idols. And in particular, they were asking about spiritual gifts, because they had a lot of them. In fact, Paul thanked God that they had tongues and prophecy and miracles. They had all the spiritual gifts. Every church member at Corinth had been baptized in the Spirit, and every church member at Corinth had a spiritual gift. And Paul thanked God that they were such a charismatic church. But at the same time, they were a carnal church. It's possible to be charismatic and carnal. And that means quite simply to have all the spiritual gifts, but to lack the spiritual fruit that you need in order to handle the gifts properly. But they were asking him about that, so at one point in the letter he says, now concerning spiritual gifts. Now, since Paul is sometimes dealing with their questions, we have a bit of a problem in these sections as to when Paul is quoting what they say or when he's quoting what he thinks. And that's led to some misunderstanding and some difficulties of interpretation. For example, at one point, Paul says, it is good for a man not to marry. But is he saying it, or is he quoting them? And if you read the whole sentence, it is, now for the matters you wrote about, it is good for a man not to marry. Do you see? It might mean they were saying, isn't it good for a man not to marry? Because Paul actually then goes on to give a very high view of marriage. So that we've just got to be a little careful. When is he quoting them? For example, when he says a woman should be silent in church. Is he quoting them, or is he quoting himself? Because in this very letter, he encourages women to pray and prophesy in church. You see the kind of problem. So I'm just putting that in because we've got to be rather careful with 1 Corinthians when we interpret it and apply it. You've just got to be very careful that you're not quoting something as from Paul, where in fact he's quoting what their letter is saying, which he then deals with. You got the picture? But otherwise, most of it is fairly straightforward. Well, now, applying the book of Corinthians is the problem. And some people make it into a legalistic code and apply it literally and legalistically. And I want to give an illustration of this. We are not so much slavishly to copy the practice as to find the principle that Paul is applying and then apply that in our situation. You follow me? Let's take one example from outside Corinthians to make plain. It's amazing how many Christians have thought that Jesus wanted us to have a ceremony in church of washing feet. And so churches from time to time have said that next Sunday we're going to have a foot washing. And everybody makes quite sure they wash their feet before they come. See? And it becomes a ritual, a ceremony. That, to me, is legalistic application of Scripture. Let me tell you why Jesus washed the disciples' feet. Because that's the question. Why did he do it? The answer is because their feet were dirty. You got it? That's why he did it. Because in those days, with feet in open sandals and dusty roads, your feet, when you arrived for a meal, were hot, sticky, smelly, and filthy. And you couldn't hide them under the tablecloth because you reclined at the meal and lay on your left elbow and ate with your right hand. So your feet were next to the face of the next person. So the first thing that was needed before you stuck your feet under the face of the next guest was to have your feet washed. And the second bottom slave in the house took the shoes off, and the bottom slave washed the feet. That was the order of merit. That's why John the Baptist said, I'm not worthy to take the shoes off his feet, to be his second bottom slave. And Jesus washed their feet. Now then, he did it because their feet were dirty. They needed to be washed, and he did it to show that a Christian, a follower of Christ, should stoop to the lowest needs of people. But a ceremony of washing feet was not what he was after. The equivalent today would be to go and wash each other's cars out there. Because that's the bit that got dirty on the way here. Do you see? And by slavishly copying a practice, we've missed the principle and turned into a ritual what was meant to be a real humbling of service to each other, however dirty the job that was needed. Well, now let's take 1 Corinthians 11. Should women wear hats? And here's a typical example of where Christians have got all tangled up. Let's say, first of all, in 1 Corinthians 11, there's nothing at all about hats. The word doesn't occur. The word veil does, and yet that word only occurs once in the whole chapter. And the statement in which it occurs is this: women have been given long hair instead of a veil. There's not a single sentence says women should wear a veil, much less a hat. It's actually about hair. And it says men's hair should be shorter than women's hair. And there's much about men having long hair as about women having short. In simple terms, the principle is that the person sitting behind you in church should know whether they're sitting behind a man or a woman. The deeper principle is that men and women are different, because the real passage is not about hats or about hair, but about head. And it's simply the principles, when you look at a man, you should think of his head, but when you look at a woman, you should think of her hair. And that clearly tells you the difference between men and women. And that as God is the head of Christ, Christ is the head of every man, and man is the head of woman. It's about heads. And letting the head be visible in the case of the man by having short hair, and letting the head of the woman be invisible by having longer hair. You see the principle. But the underlying principle is that in Christ we are still male and female. We haven't been neutered. We are still what God created us to be. And that when we worship God, we do not worship God as persons, but as men and women. And we are willing to accept what God made us. And that's why transvestism is condemned in the Bible. When men want to be like women and women want to be like men, this is a rebellion against what God has made us. And that when we worship God as creator, we come as his creatures. And we let that difference be clearly seen. So that men are saying, I'm glad I'm a man, and a woman is saying, I'm glad I'm a woman. Praise God. We praise you together as men and women. Now in our society, our culture is saying, let's obliterate all differences between men and women. And that's creeping into the church. And is causing havoc in the church right now. Where we do not accept what God has made us to be. So that the real principle is not hats or even hair. The real principle is heads. And a woman covers her head with her hair, a man uncovers his head, so that he is seen as head and she is seen as hair, and her glory is her hair. Now, do you see how we've got into the passage in perhaps a fresh way? Instead of saying, should women wear hats, we've gone to the principle, which the principle is headship. And that is demonstrated openly in our culture in the most appropriate way. I was asked recently by an African, he said, in my country, women's hair is just as short as men. It can't be anything else. It just grows in tight little curls. What do we do? I said, then you must take the principle and say, how in church can we demonstrate clearly that we are men and women? We're not neutered persons. That's the principle. Deep down, it's God who made us male and female in his own image. And our world is absolutely rebelling against that distinction which God made. And we need each other. Men and women are different. Thank God we're different. We need each other. We're complementary. We are of equal value and dignity and status in God's sight, but of different role and responsibility and function. And it's God who made that. And when we worship God, we are not neutered persons. We are men and women. And we're praising our Creator for making us so. And we thank God for each other. Now, how important that principle is. Because there at Corinth, as today, people were trying to obliterate all differences that God has put to give us variety, to give us complementarity, to give us beauty and romance. God didn't intend chauvinism, but he did intend chivalry. And God wants us to behave as men and as women, and to worship him as men and as women. And we should do that freely and gladly. Say, God, thank you for making me what I am. There's the principle. But slavishly, oh, that woman came in without a hat. There are two wrong ways of applying 1 Corinthians 11, and I've seen them both in churches. Number one, to apply 1 Corinthians 11 to the body, but not the spirit. So a woman wears a hat, but she wears the trousers as well. Do you know what I mean? And I've seen women who wear hats faithfully in church who dominate their husbands, and they've applied the word to their body, but not to their spirit. Do you follow me? The opposite angle, the opposite extreme, is to apply it to your spirit, but not to your body. And that is crazy, because we are bodies. Our spirits are in bodies. And that says, well, as long as my spirit acknowledges the headship of man, that's okay. No, you should reflect that in outward appearance. Because body is part of you, and we worship God with our body. That's to worship our body is an acceptable sacrifice. So it applies to body and spirit, that we accept the basic principle of headship, and that we let that show outwardly, so that people know we are men and women of God. Well, we'll close there, because I've still got more to say about 1 Corinthians, but I thought I'd take that one example to show you how we can get into legalistic application of Scripture, instead of getting behind it, to what principle is Paul really applying here, and how can we apply that principle today? We haven't finished 1 Corinthians yet, but before we press on, let me just mention one very important thing. Because it was a city in Greece, even though it was Roman basically, it was in Greece and very much influenced by Greek language, Greek thinking, Greek philosophy, as we all are in Western civilization. Our basic thinking is Greek. Democracy is a Greek word. There's no democracy in the Bible, whatever, but we all love democracy. It's Greek. And sport came from Greece. There's nothing about sport in the Bible except for one or two illustrations in Paul. There's nothing telling you about sport. Yet sport is the religion of the men of this country. And it came from Greece, from Olympia in the Peloponnese. And so many things come to us from Greek. And the worst thing about the Greek thinking was that they always separated the physical and the spiritual. They could never get those two things together. And therefore they had no real place for the body. Body and soul were two separate things. And I'm afraid Christian thinking has picked up that Greek idea that our job is saving souls. Well, the Hebrew never thought like that. The Hebrew thought of a person as a whole person, body and soul together. One thing. To them, a soul was a breathing body, which is the origin of SOS, save our souls, meaning save our bodies. And that's Hebrew thinking. So the real problem behind a lot of these problems at Corinth was their thinking about the body as somehow not connected with the soul. And getting into kind of super spirituality that only thinks of the soul and what happens inwardly. Whereas the body is as much part of me as my spirit. God created both, and that's why the Greeks believed that at death your body disintegrated and your soul was free. And they talked about an immortal soul in a mortal body. Whereas Hebrew thinking is exactly the opposite, that we have a mortal soul and need an immortal body. So when this mortal puts on immortality, then death is swallowed up in victory. The body is very important. The Christian does not believe in the immortality of the soul. That's Greek. We believe in the resurrection of the body. That's Hebrew. And it is their attitude to the body that they couldn't get right behind a lot of these questions. And the body and the soul were kept separate. So the Greeks did one of three things with their bodies. They either indulged them and said, no matter what you do with your body, it doesn't affect your soul. Or they ignored them and tried to live a life free from physical desires, a kind of asceticism. Or they idolized their body and made statues of the perfect body. And that's got into our Western culture. If you've seen the Greek statues, their sports were in the nude because they idolized the body. And all these are wrong attitudes to the body. And Paul has to say to the Corinthians, don't you know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit? And what you do with your body will affect your soul. And getting drunk at the Lord's table is affecting your spiritual life. And visiting prostitutes is affecting you. You are actually joining Christ to that prostitute because your body is part of Christ now. See, it's their attitude to the body that they hadn't got right. And that's why they had such problems believing in the resurrection. Because that's of the body. And still today, people have problems with things of the body when our bodies are part of what God made us to be. In the Jewish book of prayer, there's a lovely prayer to use when you go to the toilet. And it just praises God that your body's working properly, and thank God for the relief that's brought. I feel much better. Hallelujah. Now, you see, to us, that's very unspiritual, and I go into some Christian loos that really are plastered with devotional texts and have a pile of devotional books by the seat, you know? Everything to take my mind off what I'm doing and on to spiritual things. But for the Hebrew, he praised God for his body. And when you get old and incontinent, you'll wish you'd praise God when your body was working properly. See, that's Hebrew thinking. And you get the body in right understanding, the temple of the Holy Spirit. And the church is the body of Christ. It's all body, 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 do you see? So actually what you do with your body, the length of your hair, is part of your spirituality. See, it's not something that's unconnected with your soul. You're worshipping God with your body. And so all the way through we find this Greek wrong attitude to the body causing them problems. And of course spiritual gifts, because many evangelicals are Greek in their thinking, they can't cope with spiritual gifts that affect the body and feel that worship should be all inward, you know. I mean, worshipping God with your body, that's not on. Lifting up your hands, weird. You should worship with your soul. You see how it comes? Tongues is something that happens to your body. It's something outward. But we've got so Greek that everything has to be inward and spiritual. Do you know what I mean? Doing something with your body to worship is not spiritual. Yes, it is. It is for Hebrews. The Hebrews lifted up their hands to God. They danced before the Lord. For them, the body was to be offered to God. But we prefer to stand, you know. The only part of the body we're allowed to use is the mouth. Isn't that amazing? But you see, your body, present your bodies as a living sacrifice. That's the whole emphasis in Corinthians. Well, spiritual gifts are bodily gifts, miracles. Healing is a bodily gift. Oh, it's not very spiritual, is it? Because it's doing things to people's bodies. Tongues is something happening to your body. It's outward. Well, I just throw that in because you can see all the way through that their basic problem was they didn't really know what to do with their bodies. And they were doing wrong things, right, left and center. So celibacy was considered a higher holiness than marriage. And St. Augustine, I'm afraid, really put the last nail in that one. And ever since Augustine, there's been the hidden suspicion that somehow sex is not holy, which is totally un-Hebrew, because every rabbi has to be married. A celibate priesthood is an anathema in Scripture. Do you see? There is a calling, a spiritual gift of celibacy. But that's a different thing. It's not a higher, holier way than the physical act of love. Which brings me to the other major positive principle. They had never really understood what love is. And to this day, unfortunately, the English word love covers a multitude of things, and we have the same problem. When he dealt with spiritual gifts, he thanked God they had spiritual gifts. I mean, most of 1 Corinthians 12 to 14 would be irrelevant in most churches I go to, because they don't even have them. So 1 Corinthians 13 is wasted on them. It's written. Actually, chapter 12 is about spiritual gifts. And chapter 13 is about spiritual gifts. And chapter 14 is about spiritual gifts. Goes together. And chapter 12 is about spiritual gifts by themselves. Chapter 13 is about spiritual gifts without love. And chapter 14 is the true excellent way, spiritual gifts with love. But it's all about spiritual gifts. And there's tongues in chapter 13, though people conveniently ignore that bit. It's all there. But he says the main thing you lack is love. Let's look at some of the Greek words for love. They were much more careful in their vocabulary than we are. We just use love for anything, almost anything. But they had different words for it. And there were three aspects of love that they had which we need to grasp. There was the love which was sexual attraction, to lust, to be physically attracted. But they even had two words for that, one of which was good and one of which was bad. The good word for sexual attraction was eros, a name falsely given to that aluminium statue in Piccadilly Circus, which should actually be called Agape because it's a memorial to Lord Shaftesbury, and it's the angel of mercy, not Cupid. But there it is. Everybody knows eros in Piccadilly. Eros, from which we get erotic. And then their bad word was epithumia. That was a dustbin word for the worst kind of lust. Eros is not necessarily a bad word. I just want to point that out, but epithumia really is. And Paul often lists epithumia as the wrong sexual attraction, which is just purely promiscuous. And that is based on mutual attraction. Some people attract that in you and some people don't. It is essentially a thing of the flesh, of the body, the shape of the body. It is essentially an emotional love. And it is a dependent love. It's dependent on that object continuing to attract your lust. And as soon as that stops, then you no longer have that for that person. And I'm afraid many marriages based on that alone, as soon as the attraction goes with age, then the love goes. It is, in a sense, basically sexual love. Then they had another word, Philadelphia, from Philo, and Adelphia, brother, which means to like someone. It's a word of affection rather than attraction. It's essentially a word of like-mindedness. You know, you have friends that you get on with because you have similar tastes and outlook. It's an affection. It's brotherly love. And it can happen between two men and between two women. By the way, when eros happens, it is between a man and a woman, but epithumia can be between two men and two women, homosexual. But this is an affection. It is essentially a thing of two minds that like each other and have sympathy and empathy with each other. It's therefore essentially an intellectual thing. I don't mean by that academic, but I mean a thing of thoughts. And it is interdependent. You depend on each other, on each other's thoughts and tastes and interests. Then there is this word which the Greeks very rarely used, because they hardly ever saw it. And agape love is a love of attention. It's a love that gives attention to people. It is not a love that is attracted by them or a mutual interdependent affection. It is a love that simply gives attention, that takes notice of someone. It's therefore primarily an act of the will. You decide to agape someone. Someone you notice nobody is caring for. You decide to go and give your attention to them. That can happen in a meeting like this. You know, some people will be naturally drawn to each other. There'll be Philadelphia here. If there's agape, then somebody may notice that somebody else is on their own and nobody's talked to them. And just they decide they're not particularly attracted to that person, but they just say, nobody's talking to that person, I'll go and talk to them. That's agape. It's a love of attention, And it's a love of the will that you decide to do it. And therefore, alone of all these three, this can be commanded. Thou shalt love. You can't command that kind of love. You can't say to two people, you shall like each other. See? And you can't say to a man and a woman, you shall fall in love. But you can tell them to agape each other. Do you see? It is therefore a volitional love of the will that can be commanded, that you can command yourself to do, and therefore is quite independent of the person you're loving. The person you're loving doesn't need to be attractive or affectionate or even thankful. You heal the leper whether he says thank you or not, because you agape them. Now, the Greeks rarely use this word because you rarely find it in people. You find an awful lot of that in the world, and you find quite a lot of that. Very little of this. Very little. And yet this is the love of God. That's not... God doesn't love us because we're attractive. Not because we're lovable. He loves us because he loves us, says the Bible. Why does he love the Jews? You find this in the Old Testament. Not because they're a great nation, but because God is love. And he chose to care for them. A bunch of slaves whom nobody cared about. And God said, I'm going to care. The word care is much nearer agape than the word love. And this was what they lacked. This is a sacrificial. That's a sexual love. This is a social love. This is a sacrificial love that is willing to pay any price to care for someone. Amazing love. And this is the love that God had for us, that while we were yet sinners, God agaped us. See? And that introduced a new dimension of love. And where that is lacking in a church, you will inevitably split a church when spiritual gifts appear. And the reason why so many churches have been divided over charismatic things is precisely the lack of agape. It is not spiritual gifts that divide. It is the lack of agape. Because agape is sacrificial love. Agape doesn't vaunt itself, is not puffed up, does not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not its own. Agape doesn't boast. Agape doesn't say, I've got a gift. Agape doesn't think it's better than anyone else. Agape seeks all things, hopes all things, endures all things. And if you've got agape, you can cope with spiritual gifts. But if you haven't, boy, they're dangerous. See? And maturity is to grow in love. Now abideth faith, hope, and agape. Not faith, hope, and eros, and not faith, hope, and Philadelphia. There are plenty of warm fellowship churches where there's a lot of affection because you've got a lot of like-minded people. You know, they're a religious club of people who have the similar tastes in music and worship. That's not agape. Agape is where you've got a lot of differences, and yet you care for each other. And you can live with that. Well, that's just a little exposition of 1 Corinthians 13. No, I must go back to the whole of 1 Corinthians just to round it off. The basic filling of the sandwich is all these problems. And the principles of the body, the principles of love, the principles are to be dug out of this and applied to our problems. But at the beginning and the end of the letter, Paul had to deal with two very fundamental things. The first is they were forgetting the cross. Because the word of the cross is to the Greeks an offense. Why? Why should a body nailed to a cross bring spiritual salvation? It's the old body thing again. The cross was too bodily for the Greeks. It was a way of salvation that had a body nailed to a tree. And they couldn't cope with that, so they forgot it. And the thing is, when you get away from the cross and forget the cross, you start dividing over other things. And Paul says, was Paul crucified for you? Was Apollos crucified for you? Was Peter crucified for you? Why then are you lining up behind a human leader? They didn't die for you. And that's why we have bread and wine regularly, to stay at the cross. And keep remembering the crucifixion, that it was Jesus who died for us, not your pastor. We're not following human beings. And you know, in the divisions in Corinth, I must mention this, there were those who said, well, we are Paul followers, we are Peter's followers, we are Lutherans, we are Wesleyans, I won't give any modern names, but there are plenty. And then in all that, there was a little group said, we are of Christ. And Paul said, that's just as bad. Now that's an interesting point. You know, I'm amused when I go to a huge city like Birmingham, we'll say, now this is not an actual case, believe me, but I go to a huge city like Birmingham and find a little new fellowship calling itself the Birmingham Christian Fellowship. As if there's no Christian fellowship in Birmingham but them, you know? We are of Christ. That is just as bad if you are thinking they have a label, they're denominational, but we are just Christians. You know, you can say that in entirely the wrong spirit. And Paul says, some of you are saying we are of Christ. And that's just as bad as saying we are of Peter if you're using that to distinguish yourself from others for whom Christ died. Never forget the crucifixion. And the end of the letter, they had doubts about the resurrection because they believed as Greeks in the immortality of the soul. What they couldn't cope with was the resurrection of the body. And heaven with a body somehow wouldn't be heaven. And still people, you know, think of dead people as floating around in long white nighties in a kind of, spooky spiritual atmosphere. Listen, our future is to have a new body, a real body that you can handle and touch like this one. I can't wait for my new body. Jesus had a new body after the resurrection that could eat fish and cook breakfast. That's our future. And actually our future is in a whole new earth. And we'll be living on a new earth with new bodies, and God will be living on the earth with us. Now that's very difficult for Greek thinking. And so they had doubts about the resurrection. And 1 Corinthians 15 is the very first written record of the witnesses of the resurrection body of Jesus. Once again, the key issue in Corinthians is body. Body. Well, I think we must leave 1 Corinthians and rush on to 2 Corinthians. Because I'm afraid I'm not here to take you all through the Bible. We couldn't do that in the time available. What I am here to do is to give you a kind of overview, a taste of a book of the Bible so you'll want to get into it and feel you can understand it. Let's look at 2 Corinthians now. It's the least methodical of his letters and the most personal. It's almost all autobiography. Paul talks about himself from beginning to end. If the first letter is for church members, this is for church leaders and ministers, and every leader in a church should read 2 Corinthians regularly. If 1 Corinthians was what Paul thought about the Corinthians, this is what they thought about him now. And the relationship was bad between the Corinthians and Paul, and it went through two phases. Phase number one, this was after he left. This is always a test. What happens after a leader leaves? I got a lovely letter after we left Chalf and St. Peter in Buckinghamshire. Dear lady wrote and said, dear pastor, things have been even better since you left. And that was such a lovely phrase. It could be taken anyway. I thought that's wisdom to put it like that. But what happens when a leader leaves a fellowship? That's the biggest test of his ministry, not what happens while he's there. What happens after he goes? Well, after Paul went, two things happened. The first phase was that they had other leaders who were good. Apollos came. Peter came. So they had other good leaders. And the trouble then was that people began to compare leader with leader and say, well, which do you think preached the best sermons? And I like the last minister best, and I like the present minister best, and I like the next minister best. You know, you get everything, don't you? Never compare leader with leader. It is absolutely fatal because none of them was crucified for you. But then in the second phase, they got some bad leaders. Leaders came into Corinth who claimed to be special apostles. Interesting that they used that title. And they said, you really need us. You really need an apostle to cover you. So we've come to be your apostle. The same thing is happening today. And these leaders came and they criticized their predecessors. And to build themselves up, they pushed Paul down. That's... always beware of a leader who criticizes his predecessors. Always beware of someone who raised himself by putting others down. And this happens, and it happened at Corinth. And these special apostles came in and took the church over. And what they were saying about Paul was terrible. Now, 2 Corinthians reflects these two phases. The first part of 2 Corinthians reflects the criticisms that were being made of Paul. Let's just go through some of the, sorry, not so much the first half. 1 Corinthians does reflect some of the comparison of Paul with other leaders, but 2 Corinthians reflects these bad leaders who are not just being compared with Paul, but who were actually putting Paul down officially and saying they didn't take you far enough, we're the real apostles and we'll take you the whole way sort of thing. They were accusing Paul of fickleness, of always changing his plans, of being cowardly, that he would write rather than visit them, that when he was present he was timid. He was only bold when he wrote letters to them, but when he was present he was very different. They criticized him for not having any testimonials, any accreditation, any letters of recommendation. They came with certificates of, you know, university degrees. It's called emptying the church by degrees. But they came with qualifications that they could frame and put up on the vestry wall. You know the kind of thing? And they said, Paul has no qualifications. He has no letters of recommendation. That's why Paul in 2 Corinthians says, I don't need a letter of recommendation. You are my letter of recommendation. I've written my ministry on you. And that tells us the acid test of a man's ministry is not his academic qualifications or his training, but the kind of people he produces. That's the test of any man's ministry. They accused him of being secretive and less than frank. They accused him of being distant, aloof, unfeeling, uncaring. Do you remember Thessalonica? Same kind of criticisms came up. They accused him of not being a polished speaker. That's easy enough to do. I remember a Hyde Park Corner man getting up on a soapbox, and he didn't know the letter H was in the alphabet, and he couldn't string his words together. His grammar was dreadful. And 2 university students stopped to criticize him, and they said, listen to his grammar, isn't that dreadful? But one of those students was converted and became a great minister. Very famous minister, whose name you'd know. And it was the man's bad grammar that drew him out of criticism. But you see, it's easy to criticize a person for not being a polished speaker. And you know, the worst thing they said about Paul, would you believe it? They said, and he doesn't charge a fee. And they said, that proves that he's not a good speaker. Because if he was a good speaker, he could charge a fat fee. And of course, in Greece, the entertainment was not television, it was traveling philosophers. And the bigger the fee you could charge, you know, Mrs. Thatcher's after-dinner fee and all the rest of it, the bigger the fee you could charge, the greater your reputation as a speaker. Well, Paul doesn't charge fees, so he can't be very good. He has to, you know, he has to offer himself free or nobody would have him. They actually said that. And he meets all these criticisms. And he defends himself in a very sincere and tender appeal. The first 7 chapters are Paul's heart laid bare. The sincerity of those chapters. He said, of course I didn't charge a fee. I wanted you to get the gospel free. And he says, every man's work will be tested, whether it's hay, straw, stubble, or precious stones. He said, I tell everybody who follows me, be careful how you build. I laid the foundation, which is Jesus, and what you build on it will be tested. And some of your work will be burnt up and there'll be nothing left of it. Tremendous passion in this letter. His heart is laid bare and he says, no, I was open with you. Oh, you say I'm timid when I'm with you. Was I when I came on that second visit? I was not. And it's just pouring out a defense of himself. Some of his greatest statements are in this second letter. I wonder if I could just find quickly one or two. Here's one. He says, we are handicapped on all sides, but we are never frustrated. We are puzzled, but never in despair. We are persecuted, but we never have to stand it alone. We may be knocked down, but we're never knocked out. What a statement that is, isn't it? Here's another. Some of the most precious words for Christian ministers are here. Listen to this. As far as we are concerned, he says, we don't wish to stand in anyone's way, nor do we wish to bring discredit on the ministry God has given us. Indeed, we want to prove ourselves genuine ministers of God, whatever we have to go through. Patient endurance of troubles or even disasters, being flogged or imprisoned, being mobbed, having to work like slaves, having to go without food or sleep. All this we want to meet with sincerity, insight and patience, with genuine love, speaking the plain truth and living by the power of God. Our sole defense, our only weapon, is a life of integrity. Whether we meet honor or dishonor, praise or blame, called impostors, we must be true. Called nobodies, we must be in the public eye. Never far from death, yet here we are alive. Always going through it, but never going under. We know sorrow, yet our joy is inexpressible. We have nothing to bless ourselves with, yet we bless many others with true riches. We are penniless, and yet in reality, we have everything worth having. These are magnificent statements. Can't read them without being moved. He's defending himself. He will not have lies spread about his ministry. Well, that's chapters 1 to 7. But by comparison with chapters 1 to 7, the chapter 10 to 13 are extraordinarily different. Instead of defending himself, he now attacks others. And it is a very tough accusation. He resorts to irony and sarcasm because now he's dealing with these false apostles who've come in and taken over to the detriment of the fellowship. And far from being tender, I mean, the words I read to you are very tender words. But now he really gets tough. And again, I think the best thing is if I read some to you, because then you catch the different focus. Let's just read this. I wish you could put up with a little of my foolishness. Please try. My jealousy over you is the right sort of jealousy, for in my eyes you are like a fresh, unspoiled girl whom I am presenting as fiancée to your true husband, Christ himself. I am afraid that your minds have been seduced from a single-hearted devotion to him by the same subtle means that the serpent used towards Eve. For apparently you cheerfully accept a man who comes to you preaching a different Jesus from the one we told you about, and you readily receive a spirit and a gospel quite different from the ones you originally accepted. Yet I cannot believe I am in the least inferior to these extra special apostles. Perhaps I am not a polished speaker, but I do know what I'm talking about, and both what I am and what I say is pretty familiar to you. Perhaps I made a mistake in cheapening myself, though I did it to help you, by preaching the gospel without charging a fee. As a matter of fact, I was only able to do this by robbing other churches, for it was what they paid me that made it possible for me to minister to you free of charge. Even when I was with you and very hard up, I didn't bother any of you. Does this mean that I don't love you? God knows it doesn't. But I am determined to maintain this boast so as to cut the ground from under the feet of those who profess to be special apostles on the same terms as I am. Special apostles? They are counterfeits of the real thing. Dishonest practitioners, apostles only by their own appointment. Nor do their tactics surprise me when I consider how Satan masquerades as an angel of light. It's to be expected that his agents will have the appearance of ministers of righteousness, but they will get their deserts one day. Once more, let me advise you not to look upon me as a fool, yet if you do, then listen to what this fool has to boast about. I'm not speaking as the Lord commands me now, but as a fool who must be in on this business of boasting, and since all the others are so proud of themselves, let me do a little boasting as well. From your heights of superior wisdom, I'm sure you can smile tolerantly on a fool. Oh, you're tolerant, all right. You don't mind, do you, if a man takes away your liberty, spends your money, makes a fool of you, or even smacks your face? I'm almost ashamed to say that I never did such brave things like that. Yet in whatever particular they enjoy such confidence, speaking as a fool, remember, I have as much confidence. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they descendants of Abraham? So am I. Are they ministers of Christ? I've got more claim to the title than they. This is a silly game. But look at my list. I've worked harder than any of them. I've served more prison sentences. I've been beaten times without number. I've faced death again and again. I've been beaten with the regulation 39 stripes by the Jews 5 times. I've been beaten with rods 3 times. I've been stoned once, shipwrecked 3 times. I've been 24 hours in the open sea. In my travels, I've been in constant danger from rivers and floods, from bandits, from my own countrymen, from pagans. I've faced danger in city streets, danger in the desert, danger on the high seas, danger among false Christians. I've known exhaustion, pain, lonely vigils, hunger and thirst, doing without meals, cold and lack of clothing. And apart from all external trials, I have the daily burden of responsibility for all the churches. Do you think anyone is weak without my feeling his weakness? Do you think anyone has his faith upset without my longing to restore him? Oh, if I'm going to boast, let me boast of all the things I was not clever enough to dodge. The God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ knows I'm speaking the truth. You've got to read it aloud, haven't you? The passion of it. The man is saying, these false apostles, I accuse them. I defend myself. He's doing it for the sake of this church, for the sake of the gospel. The Second Corinthians is also a sandwich, and in the middle he says, now the collection. Which is what people tend to say. But Paul had a real heart for famine relief. And I think he thought like this. He thought, if I can get these Corinthians to turn their attention away from themselves and to start caring for others, that's going to help. So he stuck in an appeal for his famine relief fund in the middle. And that section 8 to 9 contains some wonderful teaching about Christian giving. And if you want to teach your people to give, use those two middle chapters of 2 Corinthians. Well, those are Paul's letters to Corinth. The first is dealing with their problems. The second is dealing with his problem with them. With that odious comparison with other good leaders. And then even more with those bad leaders who've come in and taken the place over. And are lifting themselves up by putting Paul down. Paul will have none of that. And I underline that he is not saying all this about himself to defend his own reputation, but to defend the gospel for which he stands. Because if people want to avoid the message, then they attack the messenger. And that's a very subtle way of undoing the good that the gospel does. Well, go and read both letters and read them aloud so that you get the tone of voice. Don't read them in a churchy voice. Read them from the heart, and they come home very powerfully to us today.